Today's show is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company. For a fraction of the price of traditional therapy, you can pick an experienced, licensed therapist you relate to and feel comfortable with. Each and every therapist has at least a master's degree and has completed over 3,000 hours of supervised work. To match with your perfect therapist, go to Talkspace.com/boom. And to show your support for this podcast, use code BOOM to get $30 off your first month. That's BOOM, Talkspace.com/boom, B-O-O-M.
Beer, mustard, honey, if that's not got your taste buds going, I don't know what will. Well, the sticky sausages aren't just for Debbie, they're for you too, because Asda's extra special chipolata sausages are just £1.75. You can get all these ingredients at Asda, as well as the full recipe at asda.com/James Martin.
Selected stores subject to availability. Chipolatas 375 grams.
Wade, it opens wide for Wade. What a dunk!
To get screened.
Euro step. Basket.
Terry puts it up. Won't go. Rebound Wade.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Hello and welcome to the Heat Check. I'm Wes Goldberg. With me as always, it's David Ramil. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing pretty good, man. You sound like you're pretty pumped up after a big win the other day, so...
I'm excited to talk about this. I was very nervous, as most people watching the Heat were before that series, because all we heard about was, this is a bad matchup. This is, the math doesn't go in Miami's favor. I think 538 even said that the Hornets had a 51% chance of winning the series despite the Heat having home court advantage. But here we are after game one. It's not signed, sealed, and delivered, but the Heat are looking good. But I guess before we get to that, we have some other stuff to talk about.
Absolutely. Today, we found out the results of the annual Defensive Player of the Year award being given out, and rightfully so, I think. It went to the San Antonio Spurs forward, Kawhi Leonard.
And Hassan Whiteside was apparently not happy about that. Are you?
That's right.
How do you feel about Leonard winning it? I'm assuming nobody other than Whiteside is upset with that, but like, if you had a vote, would you have voted for Leonard or Draymond Green?
I did, actually. I think, I don't know if you participated, but both of us having written for today's Fast Break.
Oh,
I
yeah.
Think,
that's right.
I did get a vote, and Kawhi was my vote for the top pick, and Draymond Green was second, and Hassan Whiteside was third.
I had the same votes as you did, except yeah. I flipped Green and Leonard. I voted Draymond Green first just because of his versatility.
Yes.
You know, I debated on it because I think Kawhi Leonard's at, like, the better defender and like does more stuff in regards of, like, you know, tapping balls and getting loose balls and creating steals and fast break opportunities for his team. And I think that's, you know, extremely important. But the idea that Draymond Green literally guards 1 through 5, while we talk about a lot of guys who can, Draymond Green, Green literally does on a game-to-game basis. That ended up giving it to me. But on either one of them could have won, I would have been just fine with it. Like, smart people can talk me into either one, and I'm okay with it.
But. Yeah, I know. I think both of those players invite criticism from people who will want to find weaknesses in what it is they do. Like, for Leonard, it's, you know, he's a system player, whatever the hell that means, and, you know, it's completely inaccurate. And for Green, I guess they think he's kind of overrated, that he doesn't really do anything very well, when in fact he does everything pretty well. So I'm not sure exactly why they want to, you know, pick a bone when it comes to those two players, but either one of them, like you said, would have been an ideal choice. And I can see a lot of the argument shifting towards Draymond Green because of his versatility versus maybe Kawhi. I saw a great tweet about it. I want to say it was Tom Haberstroh, but I'm not sure for certain. Something about along the lines that the best argument for Kawhi winning the Defensive Player of the Year is that no one bothers to go at him versus for Draymond, everybody goes against him and fails. So either way, it's just kind of, it's kind of like the mystique of, you know, Darrell Revis had a few years ago when nobody threw to that side because they didn't want to be on Revis Island or whatever. And so, you know, a reputation precedes you in that sense when you prove it. And for Kawhi, he's proven it. You know, over the last couple of years, he's been the best defender in the league, and I have no problem. Draymond is an excellent defender as well. But I think that the bigger point then is the reaction of Whiteside. So I'm kind of curious, what's your take on how he reacted?
So, you know, I read the quotes on Twitter and I laugh because it's Hassan Whiteside. Like, this is just what he does. Like, you just add this to the almanac of Hassan Whiteside quotes. That's what's happening. And then I kind of saw, I didn't really, I should have expected, like, the backlash against it, right? People said he was whining, etc. It's hard because I'm not in the locker room and didn't listen to him say it. Like, I feel like so much of this stuff can get taken out of context in a 140-character tweet. Like, it's what he said, but how he said it, you know? I don't... Was he whining? Was he just kind of matter-of-fact about it? Was it more like... I could see him, like, kind of brushing it off and saying, I'm never going to win any of these awards. Or whining, like, I'm never going to win any of these awards. Like, That was my immediate reaction. And I don't know. I guess I'm fine with it. Like, Dwayne Wade had a good quote about it. He said, it's a good thing that he's upset with it. It means he's competitive. And if anybody knows what it's like to have a chip on his shoulder, it's Dwayne Wade, right? That's been his thing. So he recognizes that in Hassan Whiteside and encourages it. And if it's good enough for Dwayne Wade, it's good enough for me.
My thing is that I don't think that he was necessarily whining or complaining. I think he was probably just a little upset, and rightfully so, maybe, in his opinion, that he should have gotten more consideration, more votes. Maybe he would have been happier if he had gotten second. Who knows? Maybe anything short of winning the award itself would have been a disappointment for him. I know he had made that a goal at the start of the season, so I guess falling short of that is pretty disappointing for anyone. And I think also that reporters, when it comes to Whiteside, are willing to be more than just a little manipulative. I think they are more than willing to throw gas on the fire. I heard it myself behind the scenes when I heard some reporters talking about a possible situation that was brewing, and they were talking about it amongst themselves, and they said, oh, he wouldn't take the bait, referring to Whiteside. So it's clear that they're trying to bait him into saying something because, well, that's been his modus operandi for the last few years in the league, is that he gives perfect quotes. You know, he's open, he's honest, and he's direct. You know, sometimes it comes across as being a little immature. Sometimes it comes across as being a little salty, like today. But I think they know they can get a quote out of him, and they're more than willing to try and incite him into saying something. So I think that's certainly a big part of what it was. And I'm not too disappointed in what he did. I have written about something for HP about how during the Charlotte game, it seemed like he was genuinely upset about a play that he gave up a dunk to Tyler Zeller, or Cody Zeller rather, and one of those Zellers, and he gave up the dunk. Cody, he seemed kind of pissed off, and I thought it might have represented a shift in him being maybe a little less selfish and more about the team oriented play. And then on the following day, for him to be pissed off about not winning an individual award kind of looks a little bad, kind of seems a little contradictory to what I wrote. But overall, if it's just an overstatement of the fact that he was disappointed, I'm okay with it, and I think it's just really not a non-issue. But a lot of people outside of South Florida don't have much respect for what he does, which is an interesting change in how the Defensive Player of the Year award has evolved, because a few years ago, if you led the league in blocks, it was virtually a guarantee that you were going to win the award.
I mean, last year was the first year that we really decided to give it to a wing player and give it to Kawhi. Right? Like, so... I'm glad you brought up the point with him being upset with giving up the points to Cody Zeller, because even Eric Spoelstra had a quote today saying that, you know, the biggest thing that Whiteside's learned this season is you don't, like, a great defensive play doesn't necessarily show up in the box score. And when you see him get upset with something like that, you know that he's just trying to be good defensively. So if his goal was to be Defensive Player of the Year, and he learned that this season, then he's on the right track, right? This is a good thing, absolutely, I think, for Whiteside. You know, going forward, maybe he figures out, like, look at what Kawhi and Draymond are doing. They're doing all these things. Yeah, I'm leading the league in blocks by a wide margin. You know, I'm protecting the rim at an efficient rate, but, you know, it's going to take a little bit more. And Whiteside, you know, to everybody's agreement, has basically gotten better as the course of the season went on. So yeah, I think it's a good thing. As far as everybody else, you know, and what their viewpoint of it is, I'm surprised he finished in third, to be honest.
Yeah, that seems a lot higher than the narrative going into it. I think if anybody was going to be attracting attention for their block numbers, it would have been DeAndre Jordan, right? I mean, I think he was a fashionable pick, and I know he did get a lot of votes.
Paul Millsap was a fashionable pick. Tim Duncan's got league-wide respect.
Yeah. The fact that he was able to, I mean, that is, I guess, more to the critics that were talking about what, you know, his reaction, the fact that he got third That is an honor. I know it's not quite like the winning the award itself, but I mean it's a pretty substantial honor considering where he was 2 years ago. So I can understand that perspective that a lot of people thought, oh, he should just be happy he got third and shut the hell up. I mean, he's also free to say whatever the hell he wants because this is a free country, luckily, and he can say whatever he wants to. But I was a little surprised that he got third, to be honest with you. And I think that's even from our perspective, who see what he does. And maybe that's what the argument is then, you know, that we do see the block numbers, which are gaudy as hell, but there's also the blown pick and roll coverage. And yeah, that's been something that has improved over the course of the season. But even you and I, as recently as a few months, talked about the tendency to chase individual stats and blocks and whether or not that might yield an easier shot at the rim, et cetera. You know, there have been holes in his game defensively and offensively, and I think the fact that he got third speaks to how much he's improved and how well respected he is across the league by media.
It's funny that, you know, we drill in on those holes in, of his game, right? That he doesn't defend the perimeter necessarily well, but, you know,
right,
everybody's got holes in their game. You know, Kawhi Leonard and Draymond Green, sure, don't, right? But, and that's why they finish ahead of him. But is defensively, like, everybody has a hole, but he just does this one thing so amazingly well, which is block shots and affect shots at the rim, that right, he deserves top five consideration and ultimately got third place in this voting. But excuse me. You know, I think it's for some reason he's polarizing, and, or for a lot of reasons he's polarizing, and that's why we tend to criticize. So, it's because, sure, he is his biggest fan, right? He comes out and says, ain't nobody dealing with blocks, I'm built different, all these things. So we people automatically try to react like, no, like, you know, there are major holes in your game that you need to fix. But to his credit, he works to fix those things, right? Like, I don't doubt his work ethic, which was a concern coming into the season. I mean, they told that story of his first Heat practice where he had to run laps and he just collapsed in the middle, or, you know, he decided to lay down in the middle of the court. And Shane Battier, I think it was Shane Battier who told the story. Shane Battier said, "This kid's not going to make it. Like, get up. Like, you're not. This is not how you play. This is not how you make a professional basketball team, especially the Heat." And something clicked.
I've never heard that story.
You haven't?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's a good story. I don't remember where I read it. Might have been like on Reddit or something like that. But I know you don't go on Reddit because you guys fight. But yeah, so that, like, you know, with the concerns over his work ethic, he's shown to come, you know, to have that work ethic lately.
Yeah, the capacity for growth, which is a big thing for him.
He's only 26 years old. You know, we keep trying, and he's really only been playing in the NBA for a season and a half, and he's already finishing third, right, in Defensive Player of the Year voting. That's a pretty big deal.
Absolutely.
Shall we get on to the game one?
Yeah, I think that's what everybody is excited about. And to your point at the start of the broadcast, you know, I was a little nervous, not just because of the potential damage that that Charlotte could do, but even within the course of the game, there was still that sour taste left over from the loss to Boston. Mm-hmm. So even when we built up a sizable lead in the first half, even in the third quarter, I kept expecting something to fall off. And luckily, nothing did. It wound up being a pretty convincing blowout victory for Miami.
It was definitely surprising, and all we kept hearing was how bad of a matchup the Hornets were for Miami. And my main takeaway was two things that we didn't consider in the matchup, or consider or put enough value in when we were breaking down this thing, which was, number one, the versatility of Miami's players, specifically the starting five. You know, the Hornets have a lot of good specialized players. Guys like Kemba Walker and Jeremy Lin are scary because they attack the rim so well. Nick Batum is a glue guy. He's the most versatile guy they have. He kind of makes everything work. But then you talk about Frank Kaminsky, who I was worried about before the series. He was a non-factor because he's one-dimensional. And they basically played him off the court. He couldn't play defense. Al Jefferson, one-dimensional. Has good footwork near the rim. That's about all he gives you on a game-to-game basis at this point. You know, they have a lot of guys like that are just very one-dimensional. Marvin Williams, a good stretch four. The Heat didn't have to worry about him. So that's, you know, the specialty player versus the versatile players that Miami has and has always kind of gone after. You know, we saw the versatility with Luol Deng to go from, you know, fourth option or fifth banana on the starting five to leading scorer. That's a sense of versatility, as opposed, like, he has that versatility to go after his own shot, which he did. You know, all of his shots weren't assisted. Goran Dragic, to change gears from attack the basket to control the pace of the game and look for everybody else's shot first, what a true point guard would really do. But we know he has that other gear, that dragon gear that everybody talks about. Dwayne Wade and Joe Johnson have that versatility of going to the post or going to the mid-range and doing all these, and Joe Johnson to hit threes. Like, they're it's a versatile group, and they all defend well together, and I don't think we considered that. And the second thing we didn't put enough value in was Eric Spoelstra and how good of a coach he is. We forget that playoff Spoelstra is a really good coach, and we tend to forget, you know, the 82-game season, and, you know, you mentioned that thing about HP that you wrote, this was part of the rotation, and I wrote a new feature on Fansided, go check it out, shameless plug. I wrote about Stan Van Gundy and just like how like the best coaches in the NBA live for the playoffs, like, and it's playoff coaching and regular season coaching are two very different kinds of coaching, and we forget how good Spo is in the playoffs so often because we're a year removed, and he was amazing in that game. He coached circles around Steve Clifford.
Okay, let me try and get into that from a devil's advocate perspective, because I'm wondering, you saw something that Spoelstra did particularly well. What would you say were the keys to his coaching experience and how they manifested in game one?
Well, to take it back first to the four-game series in the regular season, one of the things I was very concerned about with Charlotte was Whiteside had bad numbers against the Hornets. Even though you look at the roster-to-roster comparisons, and Whiteside should be dominating that matchup. Like, Zeller, Al Jefferson, they can't keep up with Whiteside's height or his strength or his athleticism. And they do, because Steve Clifford smartly throws another defender at him every time he got the ball in the post, because he knows and he'll that Whiteside's not going to pass out of the post. And so the Heat would constantly try to feed Whiteside in the post, especially early in games, to try to get him going, and it just never worked. And he would end up, you've seen this a million times, Whiteside gets the ball, he gets triple teamed, and he just stumbles over himself and chucks up a shot near the rim. Right. Because he doesn't know how to pass. He's a low IQ passer, that's the fact. So I was worried about that, and because that Miami doesn't have the shooting to penalize the Hornets for doing that. Even if Whiteside were to be able to pass out of a double or triple team. That was my main concern. What Spoelstra did was, number one, limited just those isolation post-ups, basically eliminated them, and made sure to attack the centers in the pick-and-roll game. And he did that by, I think, setting his screens a little bit higher, but then more so setting, like, flip-flopping his screens to side pick-and-rolls to either side. And I think that confused the Hornets defenders. Like, that's the only way to put it. Like, it wasn't something that was necessarily, like, you know, groundbreaking, but Charlotte just was confused. And I think I was thinking about this during the game, the angles at which Miami attacked were a lot different than what we were seeing in the regular season. You know, going to the side, coming at it at an angle, letting Whiteside come at rolling to the rim at an angle, which is something he didn't do a lot of. He's usually just like starting at the top of the key and going straight towards the rim. I thought that was really interesting. And then the fact that he always had a third guy, and that third guy was often Luol Deng, involved in the action. So if they did just crash everybody into that pick and roll, they were able to toss it out to Luol Deng, who was not covered. And even Zach Lowe points it out in his piece this morning. It's this backdoor cut that Spoelstra actually stole from Greg Popovich, because this is that thing that Danny Green kept doing, this backdoor cut off of a side pick and roll where the help defender gets sucked into the main action going on, and then they take the pat, and then the ball handler passes it to this third cutter for a wide open score, and Deng was involved in some of those actions. A lot of guys were, Joe Johnson, a bunch of people. So I thought that was just, he added a couple of wrinkles in game one. Like, he, and that's cool because he didn't react to anything. Like, he took initiative and basically drew first blood in the series, and I think a lot of that was coaching, because what the Hornets were expecting and what they got were two different things, and that's why I think they looked so confused on defense.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised that they weren't actively trying to attack Whiteside more, because I think that the tandem of Zeller and Al Jefferson off the bench should have been a little bit more effective at trying to create situations where Whiteside would get into foul trouble, and that would open things up for them considerably. But they didn't necessarily go at him as much as I would have thought. They kept it very perimeter based, which has been a strength for them all year. But when Batum was the only guy really hitting shots from the outside, that's not necessarily to your advantage. I mean, he had a great game. He finished with, what is it, 24 points, 3 of 7. That's not great, but it's enough to spread the floor a little bit. But everybody else was pretty poor from the perimeter. I mean, they Marvin Williams in particular, which, you know, you and I had talked about it before. That was one of the key matchups of that series, was Marvin Williams and Luol Deng. And if it goes the way it did in game one, I think it's going to be a huge advantage for Miami moving forward, because I thought that Williams had enough versatility to limit Deng defensively and to create his own shot, but he went 1 of 7, finished with just 2 points. He was a nightmare offensively, and defensively he gave up easy points for Deng, who was very active cutting and shooting, you know, brilliantly, to be honest with you.
Marvin Williams was a complete disaster. Marvin Williams and Jeremy Lin in particular, those two. I went back and rewatched all of Luol Deng and Hassan Whiteside's scores this morning.
Yeah.
And they were involved in every single one of them while they were on the floor. Like,
wow.
They consistently blew help defense. They seemed just completely inept and confused. And just to go back to Whiteside a little bit, you know, one of these other things that, or to comment more on the Zeller and Jefferson not attacking Whiteside more, I think one of the other things Spoelstra did was he shortened up the pick and roll game, where you usually see Dragic, you usually see it start at the top of the key or near the 3-point line, but teams keep going under that because the Heat don't have any shooters. But what do the Heat do well? Mid-range game, right? So they kept, going back and seeing it, a lot of their pick and rolls started in that like 18-foot area, where teams respect the hell out of Wade and Joe Johnson. Like, they are not going under all those screens. And what kept happening is that, like, Jefferson was doing this a lot, and Zeller even was doing this a lot. They would collapse on the ball handler, and that's why Whiteside had such Whiteside a wide open lane.
Yeah, exactly. I noticed a lot of that yesterday. Yeah, and even if they wound up collapsing on him, he was already too far in, and with his length and his reach, it was a matter of just an easy putback. He had a few shots where even he had smaller defenders kind of crowding around him, he was able to just stretch over them and still put up an easy layup or get a foul in the attempt. So, I mean, it worked out really well. I'm concerned because everything went so well in game one.
Right.
You wonder what's next for them. I mean, for Miami, I think, you know, it would probably be more of the same, although you could probably expect maybe less offensive output from Deng and maybe more from Joe Johnson, who wasn't focused nearly as much as he could have been. I mean, Wade had a good, solid game, but, you know, even Dragic wasn't necessarily much of an offensive force. We could have gotten more scoring out of them. It speaks to the depth all of a sudden, this newfound depth that Miami has that we did not necessarily think was a strength going into the season. And now after one game, it looks like a huge advantage for them over Charlotte.
Yeah, Josh Richardson only went 3 for 11. I mean, people say, oh, well, there's got to be a regression from Deng. Yeah, Deng's not scoring 31 points again this entire playoffs, probably. But, you know, Joe Johnson, like you said, Joe Johnson had 8 shots compared to Deng's 13. You know, if Joe Johnson was hot, he's getting 13, 14 shots. Deng's taking 7 or 8 shots. Whiteside only took 11 shots. Like, he'll sometimes average 14 or 15. Dragic only took 8. Like, you feed the hot hand when it's hot. And so other guys will pick up. Like you said, Dragic only went 2 for 8. Not a great shooting performance from him. He'll be better. Josh Richardson will be better. So, but I do understand how you're concerned. Like, your concern is everything went so well. And Steve Clifford and the Hornets are a good enough coach and team to make those adjustments. What adjustments do you plan to see, at least from Charlotte's point of view?
I think probably being more active in attacking Whiteside, because I think he's such a huge threat to them and what they do. So I would imagine probably trying to get Walker a little bit more active and trying to go directly at, you know, he'll be able, as we talked about before the series began, he'll be able to get past Dragic or that initial defender. I'm a little surprised that he wasn't able to go directly at Whiteside and try and create his shot at the rim. And I'd like to see that I expect that to be the case, that they'll be a little bit more active. I think he only wound up having a couple of dump offs to Zeller, who wound up cutting at the rim on a blown coverage or whatever. But you expect them to be able to do that more often so that they can try to get Whiteside into a little bit more foul trouble or collapse the defense a little bit to create more open shots at the rim, because that was just something that was missing for them. You know, as perimeter based as they are, their paint scoring was woeful. I don't have the final numbers with me here, but it was just pretty, I think they were pretty low. I think Miami like had more shots in the paint than they had total field goals connected at one point. I'm not sure if that was the final total there, but they certainly dominated the matchup in the paint.
One thing I probably watch Charlotte to do is maybe tighten up that rotation and switch it up a little bit. They seemed, you know, it's hard to say that Clifford didn't have a plan, because Miami jumped out to a 41-22 first quarter lead.
Right.
So you have a sense that maybe he was just trying to throw something out there, but he played all 13 of his guys. And some of those were garbage time minutes. I mean, Miami played all 13 of their guys, but those were mostly just because of garbage time minutes. I wonder if Jeremy Lin sees 25 minutes again. I think that he's just outmatched in regards to the size of Miami's wing players. And then Jeremy Lamb only had 4 minutes. So you wonder, he's a little bit bigger. He's a little bit more athletic. Maybe he sees a little bit more minutes. Tyler Hansbrough, 4 minutes for him. I mean, he's a little bit bigger. Maybe they use more of him and less Frank Kaminsky if they want to kind of attack Whiteside, like you were saying. I expect them to maybe tighten up the rotation and come in with a game plan and at least just try to get everybody on the same page, because it just seemed like Charlotte was never on the same page, and it would probably be easier if you had only 8 or 9 players to get everybody to play, you know, on that same page, as opposed to throwing 13 guys out there and expect some sort of continuity. That's one of the things I'm expecting from Charlotte. Steve Clifford's a good defensive coach. I expect them to lay off of Miami's perimeter players a little bit more. Make sure, just don't let Whiteside get into a rhythm. Throw different looks at him, you know, because, you know, by the second, third quarter, Miami knew that Whiteside was going to be open rolling to the rim. I mean, they were just anticipatory pass after pass. You know, you would think that the Hornets might switch up their looks a little bit more just to get them a little bit off their game and make sure that Miami doesn't get into a rhythm, because we know once Miami gets out of a rhythm, they will sometimes have a very hard time getting back into rhythm.
Yeah, speaking of that, I saw a lot of that from Charlotte, too. I wonder how much of that we're talking about Clifford's approach and game plan. I wonder if, you know, Charlotte executed that game plan, but they kind of just collapsed, you know. Mm-hmm. It was, I saw the reference to being punched in the mouth early on by Miami, and it certainly looked the part. Like, they took that punch initially, Charlotte did, and they just couldn't respond. There was there was no bite back to them. There was no, unlike what we saw from Boston in that last game of the season, there was no comeback. There was no, oh, well, let's try and chip away at this lead and slowly build back. And part of that is Miami just doing things very well, but Charlotte just did things very badly, and they also seemed very demoralized. So I wonder how much of that was just that they couldn't respond, or that maybe they just had the wrong approach, as you pointed out. But
game one jitters, something like
that. Yeah, it's possible. I mean, they don't nearly have as much, you know, experience. I'm trying to think across the board. Batum has a couple of series with Portland.
Yeah.
They won one series last year, but he wasn't even much of a factor, was he? Wasn't he hurt when they were in the playoffs last year?
I don't remember, but I'll take your word for it.
I know he was hurt for part of the year, and I know that, you know, Dame Lillard had that big shot to propel them past Houston. Am I right there? And they, no, not Houston. I'm confusing my playoffs.
Well, I mean, Marvin Williams is experienced, but not a lot of playoff experience. Cody Zeller has virtually none. Kemba Walker has big game experience, but I don't know how much that counts for in the NBA. Courtney Lee, from his years in Memphis.
In Orlando.
In Orlando, truly, in Orlando, yeah. Spencer Hawes with the Clippers that 1 year, 2 years, however long he spent with the Clippers.
Okay, so not nearly enough, nearly as much experience as Miami, but enough to say, to not blame jitters as your excuse, not look at jitters as your excuse.
And both teams were 48-34 this season. Like, it could have easily have been Charlotte as the 3 seed and Miami as the 6 seed. I don't think it would have made a difference in game one the way that they came out and played. But I mean, these teams are pretty evenly matched. So for Charlotte to lose would have been one thing and expected, but to lose the way they lost was, I think, the surprising thing. They just, you know, they're such a good defensive team,
right,
that you would think that they would, like, they would have taken something off the table from Miami, but it's just everything worked for the Heat. And I think this is what you were kind of alluding to earlier. What doesn't work in game two? I think what does, and then Charlotte only, they only made 6 of 17 shots. They only took 17 3-pointers in that game.
Yeah.
They're one of the highest 3-point shooting teams. Yeah, they're a high volume 3-point shooting team. You expect that number to be closer to 30.
Right, which is what they shot over the course of the regular season.
Exactly. So, as far as Charlotte's game two adjustments, yeah, I think they're gonna zone in on that 3-point shot and take more of them. It's probably gonna be the main one and try to get that transition defense back in play because Miami outpaced Charlotte in that game. Like Charlotte was lost in transition defense, and you know Clifford's a good enough coach to get that ring back in.
And the free throw disparity too, that was in Charlotte's favor. I mean, if anything, they're not liable to get that kind of an advantage again. And they shot 16 more free throws than Miami did. And a lot of those seemed to come in the second half. In the first half, it seemed like they were constantly at the line and Miami hardly ever was. And still Miami had a sizable lead going into halftime. So that was certainly a big plus for Charlotte. They just weren't able to capitalize.
Miami had 20 more field goal attempts in that game.
Yeah.
They had 40, and in part because they rebounded, the rebounding edge was insane. 42 rebounds compared to 28 for Charlotte. I mean, talking about flipping the script from the big three era.
Yeah.
Isn't that to me is amazing. That to me was the most amazing stat. 42 rebounds.
Well, I mean, just look at their shooting. I hadn't even looked at this, but 58% shooting from the floor, 50% from 3-point range. This is a Heat team. I mean, that's just.
But they were getting like good looks at the rim. They were getting open shots, which was the weird thing. Oh. It wasn't like Deng hit a couple of tougher looks, like Wade did a couple tough looks, but for the most part, this team got exactly what they wanted on offense.
I know Wade started off a little slow, and he missed a couple bunnies at the rim. Like there was one in particular that rattled all the way around and rolled out. And I thought, oh man, this would have been the shot to get him going. And he still wound up with a very efficient 8 of 16. I mean, he shoots 50% on a night when he's not exactly as dominant as he has been in the past, and he's just more of a complimentary player. That's exactly what we want. And he was still able to, you know, create plays, 7 assists, 4 rebounds. I mean, limited turnovers. How many did they have? 6 as a team. I mean, is that a record for the Heat? I think it might be a playoff record, right? Just 6 turnovers in a game. That seems pretty outstanding. So,
right.
I think it was a record-setting performance for them in many regards. I mean, as far as their points and everything else, and just a truly dominant performance. So you wonder again. I hate to say, I know we've been naysayers in the past, but you look at it. I mean, moving forward in Game 2. I'm kind of confident that they're going to be able to duplicate that success, but not nearly as well. Not nearly as much success. I think they're going to be a very good team, and they should be able to bounce back. And I think this is, like you pointed out earlier, this is where Spoelstra will really make it worth the team's while. You know, with his experience, he should be able to have them prepared for what Clifford's done. And I know that he's talked to Clifford in the offseason. I know that he thinks very highly of him. They probably worked together in some coaching things, and I think he probably might have a keen understanding as to how Clifford bounces back, and that should help the team moving forward. I mean, he was able to eliminate them a few years ago when they were the Bobcats, and Josh McRoberts played a big part of that team, and now this is a completely different incarnation of both teams. But I expect Spoelstra to be able to adjust pretty easily.
Yeah, I wonder what adjustments he's going to make. He, like I said, took initiative in that game one. Does he wait to see what Clifford has? Does he maybe have a couple of things in his back pocket to say, okay, I think Steve Clifford might do this, and if he does this, I'll do that. I wonder if he's got a couple of things, or if he's going to try to come out and just set the tone again early like they did in game one. That'll be interesting. And that's why even before the series started, you and I talked about the coaching matchup here is going to be a big part of this series because we figured both teams were so evenly matched. One thing I didn't mention, I do think Charlotte's going to go small. Maybe not right off the bat, but Nick Batum at the 4 to match up against Luol Deng and maybe take Marvin Williams off the floor to begin games because Marvin Williams struggled defensively so much. So maybe you end up with like a Zeller, Batum, Courtney Lee, Jeremy Lamb, Kemba Walker lineup. So you have a little bit more athleticism and length and just stronger defenders to start the game and just make sure that Miami doesn't come out on fire, because we know if Miami comes out on fire to begin that game, I mean, it's just going to all go downhill for the most part.
So Lamb at the 3 and then Batum sliding into Williams' spot in the 4.
Yeah, something like that. And then, and Courtney Lee at the 2, right? Because Courtney Lee did a better job than Jeremy Lin did on Wade Courtney Lee at least has the strength and size. But
yeah, he wasn't much of a factor either, though. I mean, I think neither Lynn nor Lee were much of a factor.
But Lee was way better than Lynn. Lynn, like, he might not be playable when Wade's on the floor. Wade went right out and just dominated him. But
I mean, the struggles of Frank Kaminsky bring up a lot of different issues. And one, I think in context of, I think they're highlighted by the fact that they take place against Miami, you know, when Justice Winslow was available in the draft and Michael Jordan refused to accept the number of draft picks, et cetera. This has been talked about all season long. And I know that you have talked on a number of occasions to Chris Barnwell, who covers the Hornets. I was going to say Bobcat, who covers the Hornets with At the Hive. So has he ever talked to you about it? Because I know he's mentioned a few things on Twitter about how frustrated he is, you know, covering the Hornets and people talking about that they made the wrong choice in choosing Kaminsky and that they should have chosen Winslow. Mm-hmm. Have you talked to him about this?
No more than what we talk about in email threads. I mean, the idea is that let's just call them the Bobcats. That'll just get them upset. Let's just do that.
Well, we could call them Charlotte. I mean, that seems applicable.
There we go, Charlotte. Charlotte fans are upset with the Kaminsky pick because he struggles defensively. He's kind of in and out offensively because he's really just a shooter at this point. But I just, on what planet does Charlotte take Justice Winslow? I mean, they're going into the season thinking that they have Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, who is basically just a better Justice Winslow. At this point in his career, he's a defensive nightmare, and in a good way, limited offensively, but has potential on that side of the floor. Most people think he does.
And I think they had already traded for Batum and Lamb at this point also. So they've got a glut of potential guards, wing players. They don't need another one in the draft.
The only thing I see is you take the picks, right? But at that same point, like, why take the picks? Like, this is just most people on Twitter overvaluing draft picks, where it's like, oh, Kaminsky's not amazing. We should have just taken draft picks and then drafted what? I don't know what you would have drafted with those picks. But if you look at what Charlotte wanted to do going into the season, they needed shooting. And so that's why they got Batum. They got Lamb. They got Kaminsky. I mean, there was no guarantee that Batum was going to bounce back and have the year he had because he had a bad year last year. There's no guarantee that Lamb was going to be good because he's never been good. And there's no guarantee that Kaminsky was going to be good because he's a rookie. So you get as many shooters as possible and hope that one, two of them, maybe all of them are decent for you. And for the most part, they've all been good for Charlotte at some point in this season, Batum for the entire season. And it worked. Like they had Al Jefferson at center. He wasn't playable in the modern NBA. You had to get a stretch five and they went after Kaminsky. And Kaminsky, I think, has a lot of potential. He's a rookie. And unlike every other rookie in this drafted in the top 14, he's not a Hall of Famer already. So
right. Right. He hasn't made a huge immediate impact. And yeah, you look at guys like Karl-Anthony Towns, who's revolutionizing the center position in his first year at 20 years old, and you kind of say to yourself, well, why isn't Kaminsky that good? It's like, well, we've never seen anything like this before, right. So we're going to have to kind of pump the brakes a little bit. But from a Heat fan perspective, how impressive was it to see both Winslow and Richardson kind of adjust to the moment and deal with things so well? I mean, what a joy it was to see Winslow in particular, because I think Richardson struggled a little bit with his shooting, but like Winslow has in the past, he was able to kind of do a little bit of everything else, played some really good defense, made some smart rebounds, was in perfect position defensively, some nice sharp passes as well. But Winslow was dominant. I mean, he was great. And his limited playing time with Wang, Deng playing as effectively as he did, you know, he was still very good. 27 minutes, 4-6 shooting, just doing a little bit of everything.
He seemed like he always... Plus 18 off the bench is pretty wild. And I about fainted when he pulled out the Euro step against Kaminsky in transition. I mean, I had no idea he knew that. That was the first time he's Euro stepped.
Right, we've never seen it before. And then the point and nod to Wade.
How great.
Kind of acknowledging, this is you having taught me this. And then Wade afterwards talking about how much he loves this rook and what a pleasure it has been to, you know, kind of mentor him and things like this. So this is a nice thing to see, you know, with a team that doesn't value the draft as much, they really nailed it on these two picks, and they're a big part of the team moving forward. But yeah, to
And then
see them.
Richardson, I mean, he only went 3 for 11, like I said, but he shot 11 times. Like, that's encouraging to me that, you know, you don't miss your first few shots and you're just like, oh, I just don't have it tonight.
Right.
And then end up being passive and just try to just get rid of the ball every time you get it and just say, oh, No, he's confident in his jumper, which is says a lot because he hasn't been a good jump shooter until just recently since the All-Star break.
Right.
Like, he's already got that confidence, and you know that, you know, his teammates are probably saying, no, keep shooting, dude. Like, we need you to make those shots. You're the only one that can make those shots. So, you know, I think that says a lot. From the, you know, go 3-11, not great, but to shoot 11 times is important.
And then, yeah, like I said, to do a little bit of everything else. 5 rebounds, 3 assists,
yeah.
I mean, a steal. Very effective, you know? I mean,
Plus
that's
22.
All you can... That's all you can hope for. I mean, he played 35 minutes. And I guess most of that was because he was still out there in the fourth quarter when Wade was already out of the game and Dragic was already out of the game. He got a lot of minutes along with the peculiar decision to keep Joe Johnson out there late in the fourth quarter. I didn't quite understand that, but it all worked out, I guess, because it was still a very good game. I guess Spoelstra kind of wanted to see if they had a run left, that Joe Johnson was the guy who would be able to squash that, and it worked out for Miami. He didn't really need to because they were just able to maintain the lead that they had already built out.
Might have been a
but
little bit
we
of the yips from that Boston game too.
Possibly. Yeah. Possibly. And I think more importantly, though, it led to the huge offensive explosion from Darrell Wright.
How fun was that?
That was great. If for no other reason than because... Like, to seeing the celebration on the bench, it was worth it just for that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the bench was, did you watch the TNT broadcast?
Yeah.
They kept panning to the bench, and I loved it. I mean, the bench was just going crazy that whole game. Chris Bosh and Hassan Whiteside, was it Stoudemire? Reenacting Whiteside's strong finish when, I think it was Zeller, like, pulled one arm back, and he still just dunked it with one arm and hang from the rim with one arm.
Oh, it was Winslow... And I don't care remember who it was. It was Winslow and somebody else that was kind of like,
okay.
Yeah, Winslow was the one flexing as Whiteside was. It was pretty impressive. But yes, when Wright was shooting, Wade, he seemed like a big, giddy kid. He was running out onto the court. He just couldn't contain himself. Seeing his boy, you know, Darrell, after years of not being with the Heat and to be back here and, you know, to have 8 quick points, 3 of 3 shooting. Sure, it's garbage time. It was already a huge win for Miami, but... Just to see them out there, and Udonis was equally giddy. I mean, that's just something you're not used to seeing. But this team looks like they're having fun at just the right time. And sure, why not? You got a guy like Briante Weber who's able to contribute defensively.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Darrell Wright who brings some veteran leadership there and some familiarity with the process. It has the makings of a very good, solid, deep team.
Right. And I think, you know, Briante Weber and Wright and some of these guys getting some garbage time minutes, Josh McRoberts getting 4 minutes as well in garbage time. And 2 days rest, that bodes well for the Heat.
Right.
They're getting a lot of rest.
Yeah, it's not like the playing time is going to make a huge difference, but it helps. It doesn't hurt. You know, maybe it doesn't help a huge amount, but it's good to have them go out there, get that out of their system. Hey, we played in this playoff game, whatever. You're done now. I mean, for a guy like Weber, who's never had this experience before, he's on a pro roster in the playoffs, and he got to play in a huge blowout win. I mean, that's always encouraging there. That,
mm-hmm.
that kind of reminds him that he's earned it and that he's gotten a chance, an opportunity that he didn't expect to, maybe even as much as a month ago. He wasn't expecting to be part of a roster in a moment like this. And he, you know, he was able to earn it and get to it. So that's great and encouraging.
So feeling good after game one. Game two is Wednesday.
There.
We already gave predictions, I think, before the series started. Or we didn't. I don't remember.
No, we didn't.
Okay. I don't want to give a prediction.
Yeah, we're done with that. We've
That's
gone
right.
down that dark path before, and we've screwed ourselves. So we're not going to do it anymore.
Any final thoughts?
On the series or the game one? The game one was great. The series... You know, I don't think it was a deciding game by any stretch of the imagination. There's still a lot left, and you know, a lot of people still think that Charlotte has a good opportunity to eke out a victory here. If they win on Wednesday, you know, clearly the momentum shifts back in their
mm-hmm.
favor. I've seen a lot of people pick Hornets in 6, Hornets in 7. So clearly they still have the capacity. I mean, we can't go in there thinking that this is going to be a cakewalk, and mm-hmm. I've seen that issue already addressed. I think Ira Winderman wrote about it earlier today, whether or not Spoelstra was going to have his team engaged. You expect that to be the case. I don't think Spoelstra, at this point in his career or with this kind of team, I don't think he's going to be lackadaisical. I think he's going to have them focused and engaged and ready to take a punch, because you know Charlotte needs to win. So they're going to be much more engaged, much more desperate than Miami is at this point.
Expect a quick leash on that first time out for Spoelstra.
Good point.
If Charlotte comes out early and Batum's at the four and Batum hits a three by stretching out the defense or something, and Kemba Walker gets to the rim and then Zeller gets a layup or something, and that first time out can come within the first minute and a half. Clifford said after the game, doesn't matter if they would have lost by one or if they would have lost by 30 like they did, it's still just a game one loss. Like, there's still plenty more series left to be played. That's important. It's cliche, mm-hmm. but it's important. Like, just because, like, these points don't carry over, and we know that Charlotte's they are going to have a counterpunch for them. And the question for Miami all season has been, how do they react to that counterpunch? Because they can get out to leads, but it's been, you know, holding those leads that have been the issue. And this is kind of in that same mentality that the Heat have to have, is gotta close this thing out. And definitely don't want to drop a game at home in game two, because if anything, Charlotte's going to be extra, you know, urgent to come out and make sure that they don't get out to a 11-2 lead. You know, they're not down 11-2 within the first 2 minutes, right. I think was the case in game one, so...
Right. And the rest works in for both teams' yeah. favors. I mean, not just because it's rest and at this point of the season you need to be as healthy as possible, but it gives them enough time so that they don't linger or you know, start to replay all their bad, you know, possessions over and over. They can move past and say, all right, that was just game one. You come away with a game two win and you're still, you know, things are tilting heavily in your favor. So, I mean, you can put that bad loss behind you, just look forward to the next one. And we saw it even during, you know, a number of times during the Big Three era when, you know, Miami might lose the first game of a series and then come in and sweep the next four. So it's mm-hmm. it's certainly a possibility that if you can go in there, you're coached well, that you can just look past a big loss in game one and still be able to play more of your style in the remaining games of the series. So that's something to watch out for, I think.
All right. Final thoughts. Favorite moment from round or game one of round one? Doesn't have to be from the Heat's game, because I know you watched a lot of basketball this weekend.
Oh, wow. That is a tough one. I hadn't really given that one much thought. I guess for me, everything is, you know, through the lens of Miami, but God, that's a really tough one. I don't know. I think even though Indiana is typically a team that we don't support over here, I think just seeing Toronto kind of crumble under the moment and seeing Paul George excel the way he did, that was a pretty encouraging sign, I think. So that's something that I immensely enjoyed.
And Heat fans shouldn't want the Pacers to win, because I'm assuming most Heat fans would rather play the Pacers than the Raptors in the next round.
I agree.
I think my favorite moment was just seeing the return of some coaches. Yes. I loved seeing Spoelstra back into the playoffs. Like I said, playoffs, Bo, that's a big thing. Loved seeing Stan Van Gundy back in the playoffs. That was great. He looked, again, TNT, or was it ABC? They kept panning to Stan Van Gundy. He was mic'd up, and he just seemed like he was having a ball out there. Like, that was great to see. Greg Popovich laughing at the end of the Memphis game. I thought that was interesting, and not a lot of people I don't think anybody noticed it except, you know, I was watching it, and I'm like, he's laughing as he's walking off the court. I don't know what's so funny, but that was interesting. I get a real kick out of the coaching in the playoffs. It's when it gets ramped up, like I said. So
you're a big Van Gundy supporter. I hadn't realized.
I'm a huge Stan Van Gundy supporter. I was livid when the Heat fired him and Pat Riley came down. I was livid
until he won a championship.
Until like 5 minutes later, and I realized, oh, this is way better. but no, I'm a big Stan Van Gundy fan.
Yeah, I mean
Pepsi Swigless forever.
I've always liked him too. I thought he got a kind of a raw deal there. I know that, you know, and you know, I guess they referred to the whatever it was that happened, the dismissal, the quit, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it was. I think they've kind of just gone over it. Do you have any lasting thoughts on that? Do you think that he was fired? Do you think he quit?
from the Heat job. I think he, you know what? Mutual agreement always sounds cliche in like PR talk, but from what I understand, he was just sick of dealing with Shaq.
You've been in enough relationships before. Did you ever have a mutual breakup where you guys just looked at each other and was like, you know what, this isn't working. Let's just be friends. I've never seen that before. I sure as hell have never been in that.
I keep telling myself that certain things are mutual, but there's, you know, somebody has to initiate the conversation.
Sure. I think it's the same case with Stan Van Gundy.
You know what? You're exactly right. And then you realize, you know what? You're right. This isn't right for us. I think that's probably what it was. So not fired, but...
He probably went in there and said, you know, he probably just went in there and was exasperated. He went into Riley's office and said, oh, man, it's so hard to deal with Shaquille O'Neal. And then Riley was like, oh, you can't handle it? You're out of here. Is that right? Is that what I'm hearing? Do you want to leave? You want to quit? And then Van Gundy's taking it back like, no. I was just saying it was difficult. I wasn't planning on quitting. But, you know, if that's what you think is best, Stan, I think you should just do it. Spend some time with family. Kind of regroup. And then we'll take it from there. You know,
I think I read it once. I can't remember who wrote it. It was years back, but Van Gundy was still a little bit bitter about that afterwards.
Yeah.
Especially when he won the championship, when the Heat won the championship. And then for it to happen basically again in Orlando from another superstar center kind of leading the charge, Dwight Howard, pushing him out of Orlando. You know, and I'm sure, like, he's like, Jesus, like, I can't, like, every time I get a good center, they try to get rid of me. But, and now he's got Andre Drummond, so who knows, but. I don't know. That's my lasting thoughts. But I think Van Gundy's at a point now. He's just, you know, Jeff Van Gundy's talked about it on, I think it was Zach Lowe's podcast, about, you know, one of the things that Stan was looking for was just stability. And you know, he's got the GM title as well, so he's got a lot more control. So he wanted control, but he also wanted buy-in from ownership and stability and just people to just inherently trust him in the job that he's doing, so he didn't have to worry about all this stuff that he wanted to be the lead dog, and it seems like he's doing a good job with Detroit, so I'm happy for him.
Absolutely.
All right, we'll do another podcast some other point. Until then, thanks for listening. You can find the Heat Check on the Hardwood Paroxysm Podcast Network on Blog Talk Radio. Find my writing, David's writing, at Hardwood Paroxysm and plenty of other places. Follow us on Twitter at DRamil13, at WC Goldberg, and we'll catch you next time. Thanks for listening.
Take care, Wes.
Hey, you heard about the good news? Y'all sleeping on me, huh? Had a good snooze. Wake up, nigga, wake up. We about to get this paper. Money never made me. Made me do something, nah, can't make me. Even if the money low, can't pay me. Even if the money low, can't play me. Hey, you heard about the good news? Y'all sleeping on me, huh? Had a good snooze. Wake up, nigga, wake up. We about to get this paper. Pablo.
Steven's getting the silent treatment. He forgot he had to pick his girlfriend Kate up from Zumba class and he'd had two beers. It's just two drinks, she said. It's just too risky, he thought. He knew that a second drink can double the chance of a fatal collision. So Kate got the bus in a sweaty lycra. She doesn't do buses. She does do silent treatments. Steven, getting the silent treatment, but alive. Think, if you've had that drink, don't drive.
Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.